Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
No matter the country, every democracy has rules. Some of them are written down, most of them even, but not all of them. Some of them are just good faith assumptions that all parties agree to abide by until they don't.
Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley says he will object when Congress convenes to certify the Electoral College vote next week.
We should allow the rule of law to operate. We should allow the legal process to move forward.
More than 100 representatives in the House and at least 13 senators are expected to raise challenges in one of six swing states or more.
Mr. President, I and 55 other members of the United States House of Representatives object to the electoral votes of the state of Nevada in order to protect the lawful votes of Nevada and all other American citizens.
Now, Canada is a different sort of democracy than the United States. We have different rules. We have different checks and balances. We have more independent and nonpartisan oversight. However, we still have political conventions that we expect our elected officials to follow. Those conventions aren't actually enforced by much, other than that's just not how we do things here. In case you're still wondering here, believing that your opponent would always respect the norms of democracy and always play by those unwritten rules goes a long way towards explaining how our American friends found their democracy in such dire straits. So this episode is the ultimate in our ongoing Could It Happen Here? Series. How healthy is Canada's parliamentary system? How much of it is strictly bound by the rule of law? And how much of it relies on everyone agreeing to play fair? When one party accuses the other of planning to rig an election in Canada, what do they mean exactly? And how much of our democracy, or any democracy really, is a simple matter of a belief that can't really be written into any kind of document at all? Are you ready for a little Canadian civics lesson? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Stuart Prest is a political scientist, a researcher, and a professor based in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello, Stuart.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Maybe before we start in on Canada, you could explain to me, before Donald Trump took office, how confident would political scientists have been in America's system of checks and balances?
Well, it's interesting. There are some different answers depending where you look in the discipline of political science. People who study U.S. institutions directly were, by and large, quite confident. They look at these institutions that have more or less stood the test of time for 200 years, more than 200 years now, and survived some real challenges. There was a fair amount of confidence there. Those who took a more a broad view, those who were comparativists, as we call them, who look at variations in institutions across countries and so on, were a little more nervous because there are some particular flaws in a presidential system that we have seen fail elsewhere, and in a number of examples in Latin America and so on. And so there was a little bit of concern there, and particularly looking at the effects of certain strains of populism in other countries around the world. I think there was some variation among political scientists, but the sort of mainstream view was that the United States has weathered many storms before, and this would just be another one.
How did Trump manage to break that assumption? I think we've heard a lot about just destroying the norms. How did that work exactly on a political level?
Well, he used a number of different techniques here. I think partly it was a function of institutions that had already been weakened by various processes that he was able to take advantage of. So it wasn't things that he started or created out of whole cloth, but the, sort of the creation of an alternative information universe in the United States was a big one. And that had a process that had been going on for some time with creation of cable networks in the 1990s and the advent and rise of the internet and the role of social media in helping people to create their own information bubbles. It became much easier for people to hear only one side of a story and not really have their assumptions challenged by reporting that might poke holes in an argument. And so that was a big one. And Donald Trump was able to essentially just say what he wanted the truth to be. And those who were taken in by certain parts of his message, who found some elements of his message appealing. And there were some things he said that a number of Americans clearly found appealing. The other elements of it, the things that didn't hang together so well, weren't challenged, and so he could sort of create this momentum. And then having the Republican Party more or less fall in line behind his messaging rather than challenging things that were clearly not true and not in the interests of the country and it turns out in the interest of the party due to the structure of institutions in the United States and this gets a little more complicated. We can talk about the role of the primary process, the ways in which politicians fear loss of office. It often has more to do with falling out of line with this dominant view within their own party. And so Donald Trump was able to sort of create his own reality, and he was able to find ways to convince a significant share of the Republican Party to go along with it. And then so that became a very formidable base from which to try to advance his own interests.
As part of trying to understand Trump and America on this podcast, as it relates to Canada, you know, we've asked about the sentiment behind him and disinformation and the role of white supremacy and the rise of hate groups and how all of that applies to Canada in the sort of could it happen here method. But I want to ask you about our specific political system. Is it structured in such a way to prevent the kind of threat to checks and balances that Trump presents?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things we can look to in the Canadian sort of the formal institutional structure of the country that would make it more difficult for the head of government to pursue a course along the lines of what we're seeing from Donald Trump. And one of the big differences that we look at, the differences is between, say, a presidential system and a parliamentary system like Canada's, is the fact that in the presidential system, the president is the head of government and the head of state. There is no office whose job it is to basically say no to the president when they are trying something that falls beyond the constitutional ambit of the office directly in the way that in Canada, that's precisely the role of the Governor General. So that might be the first place we look, where the Prime Minister isn't ultimately responsible for determining when it's time for them to go. The Governor General plays this important role in determining who should actually be the First Minister, both at the federal level and the provincial level. And so that creates a certain amount of insulation. And we can unpack that role a little bit. But that's one place to look. Another place to look might be the ways in which Canada tries and I think has largely succeeded in making the machinery of democracy, the elections themselves, an independent and impartial process. So the oversight of that electoral process is nonpartisan and by and large has been above reproach. So we don't see the potential for calling into question the actual process of democracy in the way that we saw in the United States. So we can unpack either of those, and there are other things we can look at as well.
Well, let's start with the Governor General, because for as long as I can remember, and including how I learned about the Governor General way back in political science in university, that position, while technically having all the duties that you mentioned, is largely seen, I think, by most Canadians as symbolic and as rubber stamping the requests from the Prime Minister or his party. And can you give me some examples of when the Governor General might step in? Has it ever happened? What does it look like?
Well, it very rarely happens that the Governor General plays a real role in Canadian politics. You're quite right. It's by and large a very symbolic ceremony. ceremonial office, but occasionally it matters, and it matters a great deal because it is ultimately determining who should be forming government. So a recent example we saw play out was here in British Columbia, actually, with the election in 2017, where Christy Clark won the most seats in the legislature, but did not have enough to form a majority. Because she was the premier going into the election, she was still the premier after the election was over. And so she basically had a choice to make. She could simply resign and acknowledge that the other two parties had enough seats in the legislature to defeat her, and they were signaling that they wanted to work together, the NDP and the Greens. But she also had this opportunity to try to present a speech from the throne and try to win enough votes. She only would have to peel off a couple of seats from the opposition in order to maintain her majority in the legislature. And if she was able to do that, she could continue on governing. And so she chose to do that. She presented a speech from the throne, and it was defeated.
A dramatic, historic day. For the first time in more than half a century, a BC government was defeated on a confidence vote. That means the Liberals are done.
So there, she then has another choice to make. She could resign and in so doing allow the lieutenant governor to invite someone else to form a government, or she could recommend to the lieutenant governor that fresh elections should be called, that the legislature, in her view, is unworkable. So that's a choice that the first minister has. But then the lieutenant governor ultimately gets to decide what happens. And in that case, Christy Clark was a bit ambivalent. Ultimately, she recommended that a new election should be held, but because there had just been an election, the lieutenant governor looked at the facts and said, well, no, I think the British Columbians have returned their views, and I'm going to look to John Horgan to form a new government.
It's my honor to stand before you. I've just spoken with the lieutenant governor, and she has asked me if I have the confidence of the legislature to form a government, and I've told her that I do.
And so ultimately, the lieutenant governor was there to say no to the premier in the final analysis. And in the United States, there isn't really a single office who would ultimately just say no, and that would be the final word on who is going to be a governor. We have instead this elaborate process of election certification running through the state houses and then ultimately through Congress. And so it's that checks and balances that is meant to hold the president to account. But in the parliamentary system, the lieutenant governor or the governor general plays that much more specific role, just to ultimately determine who should be the chief should be the first minister of government.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I'm glad you mentioned certifying the election, because that was something that obviously was a huge part of the fight over democracy in the United States. And Elections Canada made no shortage of hay off of their own system with posts on social media about how, you know, we only use paper, our elections are 100% fair, never in doubt, etc. What is so different about the way we run them that couldn't be called into question, say, by a party who lost a close race?
You can think about it in terms of institutional insulation. It might be one way to phrase it. So in the American system, and this the reason it's structured in this way is a bit of a historical accident, I guess. It's more or less been a similar constitutional process for more than 200 years. And at the time the American Constitution was written, it was quite an advance in the way in which power was being held to account and constrained through processes of elections. It was a revolutionary document in that sense. And so the choice at the time was seen to be, do you place power in the hands of a monarch, or can you have a role for the people to hold that power to account? And so the Constitution was written in such a way that the representatives of the people would be the final arbiters in terms of who would be that chief executive for the country. And so there was a strong role to play for Congress in certifying the outcome of the election. And it was up to the states themselves to determine how the elections would be undertaken. And that was a real step forward, to have people accountable to the people making those decisions. Since then, in Canada, in the parliamentary tradition, we have built a very strong tradition of an impartial, nonpartisan civil service, and that extends to the conduct of the elections. And so Canada has created a different form of certification of elections. It doesn't run through Parliament directly. It runs through effectively an officer of Parliament, in the chief electoral officer. So that person is appointed by Parliament, not directly by the cabinet or the prime minister. And it is up to that person to ensure the fair conduct of the elections. And so, whereas in the United States, the conduct of elections is overseen by legislatures, members of legislatures directly. In Canada, the conduct of elections is overseen by this impartial, nonpartisan civil servant with a nonpartisan civil service working for them, or a series of officials. And likewise, for the determination of boundaries for ridings in the country, there's an electoral boundary commission for each province that plays that same sort of role of creating institutional insulation, so that the people who are drawing the maps are accountable in a nonpartisan, impartial way to the legislature as a whole. And in many states in the United States, it is much more closely linked to the actual politicians themselves in determining the structure of the elections and the drawing of boundaries. And so that's why we see things like gerrymandering, and that's why we see a political contestation over the determination of whether the election was fair or not. In Canada, it's basically, if the chief electoral officer says this was a fair election, that's the final word. And then that is the result that is fed into determining the makeup of the next parliament.
I don't know if you saw it, but there was quite a stir recently on social media when people began circulating a page that had previously appeared on the Conservative Party's website, in which the party accused Justin Trudeau of rigging the next election. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did see that. And I saw, so there was a bit of a stir, and then the page was pulled down with a cheeky sort of 404 message on the Conservative website.
Yeah, but when they talk about Trudeau rigging an election, then, given what we've just gone through about, you know, how nonpartisan this process is in Canada, what are they referring to?
I did not go and see the exact argument they were putting forward, so I can't say it. I have to go and look up what their specific argument was. I can say that that kind of messaging is potentially quite problematic. That if you don't have a very good reason for saying an election is going to be rigged, that language is incendiary, and because it calls into question the fundamental processes by which we choose our government and hold our governments to account. So I think such language, we have to be very careful making those kinds of accusations. And so it's good to see that if that argument they were trying to put forward was not well substantiated, that it was just to try to generate some fundraising opportunities or something like that, they've backed away from it. But just putting that message out there, given that Canadians do watch what's happening in the United States, there is a certain amount of it's limited, but there are some Canadians who find that sort of Donald Trump type message of skepticism of elites and of democratic institutions. There is some audience for that in the country, and by having a major political party embrace that kind of language, if we were to see that would be a real danger, because the fundamental trust in the democratic process is only ultimately as good as the commitment of the political actors themselves to uphold it and agree to it. There has to be some sort of agreement among all parties to democracy to respect the outcome of the contest. If they don't do so, then that is when we start to see democracies weaken and potentially fall apart.
I also want to ask you, before we let you go, about what kind of potential for change there is in our system. So, you know, assuming the liberals or even whomever was in power had a majority, how far could they go in terms of changing the electoral system? And I mean that in either direction, because I know the liberals had previously promised electoral reform, which a lot of people saw as beneficial to strengthening democracy. But if they wanted to go in the other direction, you know, how much power do they have to change our elections and to change the checks and balances?
It's a good question, and it gets into some of the what you might call the more informal norms and institutions and practices that we have in the country that are important components of our electoral guardrails or democratic guardrails, if you want to call them that. So the Elections Act can be modified by the government of the day. So it is possible for a government simply to enact legislation to change the way in which Canadians vote. You could see that. You could even see a government, perhaps, or a party campaign explicitly on a platform of electoral reform, say, if we are elected, we are going to change the way Canadians or whichever province it is vote. And they make an explicit part of their campaign platform, and then they are elected. They could say, we have a mandate to do this, and then they could go ahead and do that. A party could even try to do that without establishing that kind of claim to legitimacy, but if they were to do so, then we start to run into some of the more informal checks on governments trying to change our democratic processes, because we have had examples of parties that have or governments that have tried to change important components of the way in which we conduct elections more or less unilaterally. There had previously, prior to, say, about 2000, been an understanding that if we were making changes to the way in which elections were conducted, changes to the Elections Act, there would be some measure of a consensus among the parties, that we would see the government of the day consult with the opposition parties and not make any changes unless there was a certain amount of acceptance from the major opposition parties. And so around, say, campaign financing, that had been previously the expectation. When Jean Chrétien changed the way in which elections were financed to reduce the role of corporate and union donations and to move towards a voter subsidy structure to support political parties, though, he didn't have the total buy-in of all opposition parties. And so that actually created a bit of a precedent for parties to try to change some aspects of the way in which elections happen in Canada without consensus among all parties. And so we saw the Conservative government under Stephen Harper tried to do a similar sort of thing with the Fair Elections Act.
Criticisms of the government's proposed Elections Act changes have expanded beyond the world of politics. Now a group of 150-960 university professors and academics have weighed in. They've written an open letter that raises a number of concerns. Let me show you a part of what it has to say. We urge the government to heed calls for wider consultation in vetting this bill. While we agree that our electoral system needs some reforms, this bill contains proposals that would seriously damage the fairness and transparency of federal elections and diminish Canadians' political participation.
And this is where we get into some of those informal checks, because when the Harper government brought forward the Fair Elections Act, it was changing rules in a number of aspects of Canadian elections, such as the kinds of ID that would be accepted, the ways in which someone without, say, a fixed address or the normal forms of identification could get themselves verified as a voter, and so changes to those kinds of rules. And there was an enormous amount of outcry, not just among the opposition parties, but among broader, what you could call civil society. So there were open letters from academics, from groups of lawyers, groups of political scientists. It became a real point of concern among the broader Canadian public. And while the Harper government could have just gone ahead and enacted the legislation that they had initially proposed, they had the sort of the authority to do so as a government. They had the votes to do it in the House of Commons. Eventually, they blinked, and the Harper government was not predisposed to blinking, to backing down from things they were trying to do. But just the severity, the amount of of outcry made them reconsider some of the things that they were trying to do. And so they ultimately passed an amended version of the act, but some of the most controversial elements of it were taken out. And so this is, again, another example of the sort of different layers of democratic insulation that we have in Canadian society. Not all of them are going to be formal. Ultimately, it's up to the parties themselves to commit to follow rules and not to cry foul when there is none. And it's up to Canadians more broadly to keep an eye on things. That's the ultimate check on democracy. If a party is behaving in a way that is perceived to be not supportive of democracy, then it's incumbent on Canadians to call them to account on that point. And even when it's a majority government, if the pressure is enough, governments want to be reelected, and they will worry about the fallout of an unpopular decision, and they may back down, as we have seen.
Does it worry you that in that example seemed to rely on an awful lot of informal checks and outcry from regular Canadians? Isn't that, and I'm not trying to be alarmist here, but it does interest me that kind of informal stuff sounds an awful lot like some of the norms that were just demolished to the south of us.
In a sense, yeah, it is similar. The fundamental foundation of democracy ultimately rests with the people and the people exercising oversight on government. And you can't ultimately legislate every aspect of democratic governance. At a certain point, it's going to depend on people doing the right thing. And ultimately, the final check is that the people are watching those making decisions to make sure that they are doing those right things. And when they do not, that there is a consequence. And that consequence is ultimately at the ballot box. So these norms help us to understand when something is being done that is inappropriate, that we can't necessarily build a strong rule around. And that requires us to rely on different communities. So the legal community keeping an eye on government to make sure that they're not abusing, say, the ability to prosecute or to use the rule of law against citizens. Political scientists keeping an eye on the use of different aspects of legislative and executive power, and essentially alerting Canadians to when there is an abuse of power. And this is why we rely on different sources of information, like the media as well, to help alert us to when there is a problem, to have independent alternative sources of information. We need all these pieces, and we can't simply rely on the state to provide everything. The state can't simply supervise itself. Somebody at the end of the day has to be keeping an eye on those people making the decisions. And so if that seems a little bit uncomfortable, I guess it is, because ultimately we're trusting in a democracy that the people will know what's right and they will make the right choice when it comes time to do so. And experience tells us that they don't always do that. And that's one of the reasons why we continue to learn about history, teach history, to develop civic literacy in citizens so that we all understand the stakes involved. And when the time comes, we do the right thing to safeguard these institutions that have served us so well for so long.
Stuart, I find that hopeful, but also terrifying. And thank you so much for helping us puzzle through this.
Well, thank you. I enjoy the opportunity to chat.
Stuart Prest, a political scientist out of Vancouver. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find all the other episodes about how Canada could eventually find itself in the same position as our friends to the south. You can also talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can find us via email, TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. And yes, we're in podcast players, every single one of them. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, doesn't matter. Find us, rate us, review us, tell your friends, all that good stuff. Thank you for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.